Well, hey, welcome to the September edition of the Watermark Equipping webinar. My name is Nathan Wagnon. I'm the Director of Equipping and Apologetics here at Watermark and one of the hosts of this webinar. And to my left, seated next to me is...
Nyga Spaulding, and I have the pleasure of being the Director of Women's Equipping and Curriculum here at Watermark Community Church. And then I'm staring into the lovely eyes of...
But before we move on, I've got a note that people can't see us, which is probably a good thing for multiple reasons, but you're wearing an Oklahoma hat.
Nate.
What's going on with Oklahoma right now?
You know, God just brings love the mighty from time to time, so we will rise again. So I'm counting on it.
Hopefully sooner than later.
Hopefully sooner than later. I'm a real fan over there with Dr. Bob. So maybe it's time to move on from this before we end up in.
Okay, that's right. I just wanted to say that my Hogs are 3-0 right now. So
yeah,
anyway,
pig soon.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
So the person who's fielding your questions and interacting with you today is the queen of puns, Sylvia Bateman.
Man, hey everyone. Yeah, Sylvia Bateman here. I also get to hang out at MoneyWise, and so if anybody's joining us from MoneyWise last night, we're glad you made it today as well.
That's
glad
awesome.
You're here.
And then today we really are blessed to be joined by Dr. Daryl Bach. He is the Executive Director of Cultural Engagement and the Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. So at DTS, they obviously have different departments, and he's one of the main guys in the New Testament department. But then they also have a Center for Leadership and Cultural Engagement that is it still called the Hendricks Center?
It's the Hendricks Center.
The Hendricks
yeah.
Center.
Yeah.
Named after the guy that we all affectionately called Prof. But Dr. Bach is from Houston, Texas,
That's right. Is
kind of all things Houston when
That's
it comes
right.
to that. So thanks for being with us today. We really appreciate
Glad
it.
Glad to be here. My pleasure.
He's also the author of a recent book that's like literally just come out in the last month or so, right?
Well, it's been out since May.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, the last few months.
Yeah.
Called How Would Jesus Vote? Do your political positions really align with the Bible? So not that he's trying to be controversial or anything like that, but he's got that good, strong title to the book. And that is what we want to talk about today. I mean, we live in a society and in a culture that is a lot of times feels like it's spinning out of control, especially as Christians who, for a lot of us, probably grew up in a Christian context or at least going to church, where things are happening and things are shifting so quickly that a lot of times we feel like we're on this kind of out of control, crazy state fair ride or something like that. And a lot of times are left either shaking our head or shrugging our shoulders and being like, what is going on right now? And so in a culture like that, how should we think about engaging that type of culture? What is cultural engagement? What are some of the ways that we need to think about that in order to do that in a way that's Christian?
Well, cultural engagement is basically exactly what it says. It's engaging culture, only the culture isn't singular. It's actually multiple. It's layered. It is both localized in terms of its context as well as global and national. All those things interact with each other. And so when we're thinking Christianly about cultural engagement, we're asking, how do I, as a believer who has our own set of allegiances tied to being a member of God's kingdom, relate to what's going on around me in the world? And how do I do that well? How do I appreciate what's going on around me, understand and interact with what's going on around me, both positively and negatively, and do so sensitively with an awareness that my neighbor is also impacted by all this and may or may not carry the same particularly spiritual values and orientations that I may bring to that discussion. So how do I have discussions with someone about God who doesn't even believe that God exists or doesn't think the Bible is a particularly special book, all those kinds of things. So all this is wrapped up in what we're talking about in cultural engagement.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously there are a lot of different complexities to that.
That's right.
When coming to the table. And I feel like a lot of times especially for people who have gone to church for a while, we, like you said, cultural is plural. And so sometimes we're referred to as like subcultures or various groups. And I would say like evangelical Christians are a funny bunch of people, you know, like we can get very, just compartmentalized in our own little world and fail to see a lot of the complexities of things that are going on around us. I know for me personally, when I served in the military, one of the things that happened when I deployed overseas was, you know, a lot of my perceptions and bubbles about how simple things were like burst pretty quickly, you know? And so when thinking through like those complexities, what have you seen in your experience as you've dealt with Christians? What are some of those things you've seen that have been open doors for people to start to think about and appreciate the complexities that are going on in the world around us?
Well, there are really lots of different things. The main thing is being able to move outside of your own space and world. Thinking through what it really means to listen to someone who's interacting with you, where they're coming from, in some cases, what motivates them. I like to tell people the first responsibility in cultural engagement is to get a spiritual GPS on someone, to just get a sense of where they're located, where they're coming from, which means that you do a lot of listening and you put your truth meter on low. And if you do that, then you're in a position to really hear the person, where they're coming from, what motivates them, what experiences they've been through that may color the way they look at things, that kind of thing. And the more information like that you have, the better off you are to actually engage them at a local level and in a personal level. And so another thing about cultural engagement is that we talk about culture as if it's this thing that we all know what it is that's out there.
Totally.
And everyone's perception of what that thing is that's out there, that glob that is culture, is somewhat different. And so that's another reason for the conversation is to get located. So we talk in abstractions about culture, but actually each of us has a perception about the thing that we're interacting with. And we've got to help in our conversations to figure out if we're actually talking about engaging on the same thing or not.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Dr. Bach, when I first moved to Dallas, I had the opportunity to see you at one of these types of events where you were attempting to engage in the culture and you were in a local church and you were asked to just talk about what are things we should consider in elections. And it was supposed to be a two-part series where you spoke on the first half, Q&A, and then you came and wrapped up on the second
half. Yeah, that was at the Village. I know where that one
was.
Yes,
it was.
We weren't going to say that.
We weren't going to say it, but you're right. And you made the comment.
You know, someone said it takes a village, and in that particular case, it did.
And you said God cares about the poor. That's simply all you said. But in that moment, the timing of that conversation was right after Obama had won his first election, I believe, and their tensions were high in the room.
Yeah.
And what people heard was completely different than I think what you said.
Yeah, and if I had said Jesus cared about the poor, I might have done slightly better. But anyway.
Which brings us to the next point. And why are these conversations that we're maybe attempting to have and hopefully having, and then why are they just so hard? I mean, that should have been a context.
Because we're so emotionally invested in them. We've allowed ourselves to be so overly invested in the particular point of view that we have that we're more important in keeping our investment in place than we are in actually engaging with the person that's sitting across from us. And when we do that, we get in a defensive mode, a responsive mode, a reactive mode. You know, in some cases it's because our sense of the truth meter is set on pretty high. And then when you set it on pretty high, it's like the old pinball games. I'm probably talking to a generation of men. You know what pinball is in virtual world. In the old pinball games.
Yeah.
Okay, sometimes an old illustration can work. In the old pinball games, you know, they used to have a tilt thing that would go off if you push the game too hard and it would shut everything down for a while. When your tilt button is always going off and you're always shutting down from the conversation, you're probably not having a good conversation.
Yeah, that's great.
I think one of the more common illustrations that I think people can really relate to, especially the married folks, is just your marriage relationship with your spouse. I mean, how many times do we get into conflict with our spouse?
Oh, never.
Exactly right.
I have a wonderful wife. She thinks I'm, you know, right there next to the creator sitting at the right hand. She listens to everything that I do. She doesn't blink.
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
We all should.
Yeah. So Dr. Like Bach, one of the first steps is stepping out of denial.
That's exactly right.
Anyway, but no, I mean, when I'm in conflict with my wife, depending on my stubbornness at the time, my truth meter, if you want to, you know, call it that, it, you know, there can be massive pushback, but it takes two people coming to the table and saying, okay, I'm going to humble myself, mm-hmm. you know, allow my listen meter mm-hmm. to be raised so that I'm actually at the table able to respect you as a human being mm-hmm. and listen to your
and actually have a conversation totally. And not just a debate.
Right. Right.
And so when you engage at that level, you're trying to listen for what the other person's saying. I'm just here off an interview with KERA. I just mm-hmm. did an interview with KERA on Israel, mm-hmm. about which no one agrees. And, you know, yet another topic of, yeah, right. of you know, unanimity.
Yeah.
And we were talking about political discourse as a journalist. And I made the observation that we actually don't have a conversation. Okay. What you have is a debate. Mm-hmm. Everything in journalism is set up to be point counterpoint. And I actually think that the way journalism is set up and even the way the stations are structured and the filters they put on themselves actually takes us away from the conversations that we need to have with one another about politics, which is to recognize we live in a fallen world. There are tensions in the world that we have to deal with. Those tensions sometimes represent biblical values that are in tension with themselves, because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. they don't always go together well, because we've managed to so mix up the puzzle that we've got values running into each other. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, recognizing what the tensions are, being honest about it, and asking, how do you balance these tensions, as opposed to doing what I think we often do, which is to pick one of the biblical values, park there, and pretend the other mm-hmm. biblical value doesn't exist.
Right.
And when you go into a conversation with the recognition of, okay, my goal here is to have a conversation. My goal here isn't just to win my way or win my debate or decide whether I'm going to friend or unfriend you on the basis of what you say, you know, then I have the opportunity to have a different kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think it's really important that we do that more than generally we have.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've been reading your book, mm-hmm. and one of the things you said in the first chapter about the way our government was shaped and formed was how someone could, our founders could vastly different worldviews from one another, mm-hmm. could sit down at the table and come to common ground and set up a constitution that was set up for that.
They were trying to figure out how they could live together despite the fact that they didn't think all the same way.
Yep.
And they had come out of societies totally. Where there had been state churches and that kind of thing, where they were where you were in terms of conscience was dictated to you to a certain degree. And they wanted to create a society. I mean, our roots are mixed. We've got Enlightenment input into what we have, as well as Judeo-Christian value. Michael Novak wrote a book on two wings, and that was the point that he made. Our country was really made to serve two concerns at the same time, a religious moral element that was heavily Judeo-Christian on the one hand, that was one wing, and the other was this Enlightenment reason mm-hmm. wing that also dealt with conscience and freedom and that kind of thing. And what we've done in our time to a certain degree is we've tried to fly, but we've done it trying to cut off one wing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you actually undercut the stability of your society. Numerous church fathers would say things like, the only way to have a stable society is to have a realistic view of who we are as people and how much damage we can do to one another mm-hmm. if we're not careful. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of a society that has moved so hard in the direction of human freedom and human autonomy without any sense of accountability or responsibility, you've lost that wing. Well, I would suggest that people ought to go out and try and fly a plane with one wing and see what happens. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so we're experiencing that now. It's mm-hmm. it's been translated into us in terms of gridlock and culture war. And the question is, you know, what the fathers tried to wrestle with is, despite our differences, how can we live together?
Right, right.
And when you talk about a category like common ground, the question I like to ask is, and I'm kind of having fun, but it's also serious, is how can you talk about common ground when you hold so little in common and you can't agree on what the ground is? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's really where we find ourselves. And so we're kind of swimming.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy place to be, but hopefully Christians can be in a place of developing some care and empathy in a way in which they they listen. And in saying all this, we're not saying that you do away with your convictions Absolutely. And what you believe,
right.
but it's the tone and the way in which you gauge. It's the ability to explain, this is why I believe what I believe, without decimating the person on the other side who thinks differently than you are. And getting them, your goal actually is to try and help bring them to an element of pause in the way they think about their own lives and consider what it is you may be raising. But to do that, you've got to be willing to do the other as well and listen to what the person is saying.
Yeah, we've talked about in the past this principle that Greg Kokel talks about, the stone in the shoe,
uh-huh.
you know, where somebody walks away from that conversation, not their views haven't necessarily changed, but there's a little bit of irritation in their shoe that's like, I need to think about that some
yeah.
more, you know,
yeah.
that kind of thing.
You know, one of the ways I think is helpful for people to do that is we sometimes find ourselves in conversations about culture and we use language like we're on a crusade, we're on a war, we need to win.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've heard you really reframe this of going, instead of considering ourselves soldiers who are mm-hmm. out there fighting enemies of flesh and bone, what if we viewed ourselves more as ambassadors? And so why don't you speak to that just to help us?
Yeah, I actually have two ways to deal with this because some people really like the military. And so, and there is a conflict. You know, you've got to be able to recognize there is a conflict for hearts and souls that are out there. And, you know, Ephesians 6:12 says our battle is not against flesh and blood. Is against spiritual forces, a spiritual battle. It's a battle for souls. It's a battle for hearts. It's operating at a deep spiritual level. Mm-hmm. We need to appreciate that. What does that do to the military metaphor? What it does to the military metaphor is, rather than seeing the person who disagrees with me as the enemy, you know, or automatically painting them with two horns on their head because they don't see the wisdom that I possess instinctively, that no, what you see is a spiritual war in which there are texts that talk about rescuing people mm-hmm. from the clutches of someone who's going to do them harm. 2 Timothy 2:22-26 talks about a person being pricked in their conscience and realizing where they are and escaping the snare of the devil.
Yeah.
So the picture is someone who's entrapped, may or may not even be aware of it, in trying to release them from their entrapment. So the military metaphor I like is we're not soldiers fighting a war against an enemy on the other side. Actually, we're more like special forces engaged in a rescue operation, in which we're going in and trying to rescue the person taken hostage by those spiritual forces and release them from it. So when I see the person that I'm talking with, not as the enemy to crush, but as the person to rescue, okay, that makes a difference. Now, that's one metaphor. The other metaphor that also is a very important biblical metaphor is the ambassador metaphor. The ambassador metaphor means I represent someone by how I, not only by what I say, but even how I conduct myself in the midst of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that also is an important picture. And I actually think that's the more dominant engagement metaphor, is that we are representatives of God. We are saints who are a part of a kingdom. That kingdom is distinct from and separate from any nationality or citizenship that I have, and it actually trumps it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, I've got to be especially critical of two things. I've got to be critical of the way in which my allegiances to my nation may cloud my spiritual allegiances. And I also have to be pretty self-critical about the way in which my Christian community can get captured
mm-hmm.
by that
yep.
and wrestle through those kinds of questions. So that's I do think it makes a difference how you frame the conversation. And we're through probably 3 to 4 decades of long discussion in which Christians in the evangelical world have used the culture war as the major metaphor that we have. You know, we've got to be soldiers. And
yep.
if you're in men's ministry, my goodness, you're strapped for battle with every weapon that you can put on your back.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, do I use a six shooter or a
yeah.
bazooka? Or
yeah.
maybe a partial
sure, yeah.
nuclear
yeah.
weapon every
yeah,
now and
yeah,
then,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
And destruction and decimation is the goal. No, it's a strange war. It's a mm-hmm. war in which the person is on the other side of the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a person I'm called to crush.
Yep.
Okay. It's a person I'm called to try and persuade to come join me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dr. Barr, we've heard you talk about this too. I think if we're ambassadors to Christ, then we should speak to people in the way that Christ would. And sometimes people go, what about the times when he's calling on broods of vipers and hypocrites? And there's a very clear distinction in the
yeah.
two kinds of people that Jesus talks to when he's talking to the religious leaders who are leading people astray.
People who should know better.
Who should know better. Yeah. And they receive typically the whipping and lashings.
That's right. That's
and
right.
then when you see him engaging with those who are truly lost, the woman at the well, you see a tenderness and you see a gentleness. And I think that distinction is helpful for people to understand how that as an ambassador, if Jesus were to walk upon the lost person, how he would engage with them.
And the amazing thing is that marginalized people sense this from Jesus. They were drawn to him. Mm-hmm. Okay. They sense that even though he was challenging them, there's another tension here. The tension of the gospel is to challenge the way people live. Exactly. God doesn't walk up to people and say, pat you on the back and say, oh, you're my child. I don't care what you do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to give you a hug. Here's a teddy bear. You know, what he does is he challenges us with the way that he lives in terms of being in line with the way he designed us when he made us in his image. And that is hard, but he does it with a graciousness and a tenderness and an invitation.
Right.
Yeah. A husband you don't have.
That's exactly right.
But you may drink of this water if you'd like. Yeah.
Exactly right. And with that invitation then, it isn't that he trumps the challenge, but he frames it.
Mm.
Okay. He frames it in a frame that says, the reason I challenge you is because I really care.
Yeah.
They can sense that's when that's genuine. They won't care about your critique unless they know you care.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so how the church engages with people they disagree with is actually a very important part of the puzzle. And my fear has been that we've been so committed to being right that we've engaged in the wrong way and actually lost ground.
Yeah. So that brings up an interesting point, because I do think that you look 5 feet anywhere and people end up using Jesus because, like you said, we've been so concerned with being right that Jesus ends up being a means to an end for everybody to embrace the rightness that I embrace kind of thing. And there's so many things wrong with that I don't even know where to start. But I do think the major point that I thought about while you were talking is that if the Jesus that we're using, which most of the time when you're using Jesus, you morph him into whatever image you want him to be so that you're comfortable with him.
Yeah, he's either an elephant or a donkey.
Yeah, totally.
Or a woman.
Go for it.
Whatever. But I think that, and I think the principle is this, and I've experienced this for sure in my own life, like if Jesus is not consistently pressing in on you and making you uncomfortable in some way, shape, or form, then you're probably worshiping the wrong Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of introspection as we evaluate, like because we see these causes that we want to champion and go take that hill. And, you know, it would be so great if everybody embraced, you know, this morality and this ethic and these types of things that even in doing something that might be admirable to say, yes, we should live in a ethical society, in a moral society, we can inadvertently use Jesus as a tool to push people there as opposed to inviting them to the table as an ambassador.
And we look for the solution in the wrong place. We think that a good law can fix things.
Yep, roger that.
A good law doesn't necessarily fix things. The Old Testament is a story of a people who had God in their ear, writing their laws, telling them how to live. Okay, and it is one chaotic scene. I mean, it is. Because you had good laws, but you had hearts that were still out of alignment with God.
Yeah.
So that's why mission's important. That's why the gospel's important. The real change comes internally when a person's heart changes, not because I write an external law that makes people behave. I mean, the greatest illustration of how this doesn't work is something like prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the experiment that prohibition was, and look at the utter failure that prohibition was, because people's hearts weren't really there aligned with the law.
Right.
And the flip side of that is that if I have good theology, I understand that people who haven't experienced the grace of God and who haven't wrestled with the grace of God and who don't have the internal equipment to recognize their need for God aren't very inclined to live in the way God desires, and for a variety of reasons, something that believers actually should understand, because they should appreciate what it is that God has given them that they could never have given themselves without it. And so you've got that element in the equation. So the way this works is, if you want to know what good laws look like with bad hearts, read your Old Testament.
Yep, yep.
That's why we got a new covenant. Mm-hmm. The point of the new covenant was to say, God, by his grace, is going to supply something for you you cannot supply for yourself, and that's where real change happens. Mm-hmm. So if we look for change in the wrong place, we get over-invested in it, and we also fail because it can't bring the change we're actually hoping for and looking for. Yep. So that's why how we conduct ourselves as Christians as a part of a larger mission that transcends the political scene that we're engaged with and oftentimes so significantly invested in is so important. Mm-hmm. And so anything that we do that clouds that, that sends the signal, no, the political arena is really the most important, right, and the mission is a secondary thing. Mm-hmm. Anything that flips that actually is dangerous.
Yep.
Right. Well, you know, obviously, if you haven't picked up on it yet, as you're listening, you realize this is a very complex thing. Mm-hmm. And cultural engagement is never simple, and it takes nothing short of the Holy Spirit directing it. But part of the complexity is we deal with different kinds of problems. You know, you can't always say all problems are simple and mm-hmm. all problems fall in these easy buckets. And so mm-hmm. we've heard you talk about there being really three kinds of conversations. And so why don't you dive into those and just briefly outline those of tension, those of that are, we think we know what we need to do, but we're not sure how to get there. And then, hey, we just don't agree.
Yeah, I would submit that most of our political discussions are actually discussions of a singular type, and that is that there are biblical and human values that are coming into tension with each other, and the job, even in the political sphere, is to sort out how those tensions relate to one another. Unfortunately, that's not how we approach them in our conversation. Mm-hmm. What we do in our conversation is rather than recognize the tension and ask how do we balance these and how do we put these alongside one another, we come along and we pick between the tensions. I'm either going to be for this or for that. We sloganize it. We soundbite it. We make it our title. We use it as a weapon, mm-hmm. the side that we mm-hmm. pick. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, we don't listen to the other part of the conversation that we need to be having. And in that process, we never get to the conversation we need to have,
right,
which is how do I balance these tensions that come between each other and do so in a hopefully in a societally responsible kind of way.
Yeah.
In the book, I think I go through like 12 or 13 issues, like 10 of them belong in that category.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're as passionately engaged in whether government's big or small or globalization or, you know, make America great or how we handle gun control or immigration, you build a border or you show compassion to the person who, you know, who's the stranger in the strange land. I mean, no matter which one, you've got these things in tension and we need to sort out how to balance those and what we can afford to do, what's realistic to do, mm-hmm. all those kinds of things. And we never have that discussion because we put one side on one side of the divide and the other side on the other side of the divide. And we each cling to that without recognizing what the other person is bringing to the table. And we dig in.
Yeah, entrenched.
Entrenched. And then, because we're in a war mode, okay, we've talked about the artillery belt already.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
It's either a pop gun, a grenade, all the way up to a nuclear bomb that we deploy in order to get our way.
Mm.
And so, that's one class. The second class is actually something we've been in the midst of observing right now. And that is racial reconciliation. It is one in which everyone at least states that they understand what the goal is.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't disagreement. No one walks around saying the races should fight one another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that's what we're each going to dig in on our side. Now, everyone recognizes that there's probably some value to having the races reconcile to one another. They embrace that as a value. They just have no clue how to get there.
Yeah, right.
They are in such a different place in terms of where their experience is and what they've gone through and what they're sensitive to and sensitive about, that they just dig in. So all of a sudden, this has become a discussion between police and race,
mm-hmm.
with a little gun control mixed in,
yeah.
and maybe drugs, and who knows what else.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, all those are factors, every one of them. So you don't get to pick and choose. You've got to ask yourself, all right, how do we unravel this tangled thing? You know, race relations is a little bit like your cords you put in your computer bag. You put them in nicely, but by the time you open your computer bag to go pull it out, they've ended up managed to get tangled up, and I have no idea how it happened. You know, so So that's a picture you get. So you've got to work to untangle that. And unfortunately, this untangling is an emotional untangling. And so it comes with a lot of pain and a lot of, again, listen, that's the second class. I'm taking a long time to answer your question. The third class is the ones that we really do disagree on. There really is no middle ground. The only thing that we have to sort is, all right, how do I live as a neighbor with someone who thinks that differently than I do? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You still have the pastoral problem. You still have the relational issues of how you sort all that out. But the fact is, there, you know, someone who believes that abortion is a non-moral choice of freedom about what I do with my body,
right,
versus someone who thinks, no, there's morally at stake, something at stake in that choice because that entity or thing that you're carrying actually is a person,
a human being,
you know, and what that means. I mean, those are two completely different clashing. The whole sexuality discussion in terms of same-sex marriage is, you know, people, some say marriage is between a man and a woman. It's God ordained. That's the end of it. And people on the other side, there isn't even a God to ordain what that relationship is, much less we should dictate something about it.
Yeah.
So how do you sort that out? So there are three different issues, but here's the major point. Major point is that most of those issues belong in that first category.
Mm-hmm.
They don't belong in that second category or that third category, but we tend to treat them all as if they're in the third category.
Right.
Okay. So we ought to have some awareness of the kind of issue that we're discussing, what's at stake as we go into it. And we also need to have, even in the places where there really is a worldview clash, some sense of our pastoral responsibilities, of our relational responsibilities as we engage in these conversations.
Yeah, so let's dive in then into particulars, because I think this is helpful. So Dealer's Choice, it's your book, so you can pick any issue you want.
Yeah.
But walk us through just, you know, on any one of these issues, like you mentioned, gun control, immigration, poverty, how would a level-headed Christian come at this and wrestle through these tensions?
Well, I, the two that I like to pick out when I'm just given the, you know, when the bowl of M&Ms is set before me and I said, do you pick the red one or the blue one? The ones that I like to talk about are immigration and gun control for two very different reasons. Gun control's fun. Okay. Not really, but, but what makes gun control interesting is, as I like to say to my students, we'll go out to eat when you find me the passage that addresses guns directly, okay? And then how would you like to go on a fast? So, you know, if you think about it, the Bible's written long before guns ever show up.
Yeah.
And so there is no direct address of guns anywhere in the Bible. So how do you talk about gun control? Not only that, the government, the whole way that decision gets made comes out of a different political system than even existed in the first century. People didn't participate in a democracy where they had a choice. They didn't have constitutions that they built their societies and their lives around. So you've got that. So there's this huge difference. So how do you go to the Bible to think through that? Well, what you do is you ask, what does the Bible have to say about violence? What does the Bible have to say about self-protection? All those kinds of things. And the tension is the Bible does allow for some realm of self-protection. It even had laws in the Old Testament that distinguished. If you killed someone who invaded your tent, okay, you didn't have homes then, you had tents, okay, someone who invaded your tent at night or your abode, and you killed them at night and they were a thief, you weren't culpable. But if you killed them during the day, you could be culpable if you killed them, depending on the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he said, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he shouldn't be in there at night.
So you've got passages that talk about your right of self-protection. You've got nations that defend their interests. I mean, Scripture says the nation has the right of a sword to protect its people. That's one of the major reasons why government functions. So you've got those principles. But then you've got all the pacifism and the turning the other cheek and all those kinds of things. So those are texts that are in tension with each other. And the conversation to have is, how do you balance those? How do you balance the right of being able to protect your space on the one hand with the tendencies to be as nonviolent as possible on the other? And so that, and then you raise a question like, so when you come to gun control and you ask, how do background checks get in the way of the right. Now we've already made a decision. This is what gets me when I travel overseas, because people don't get this decision. We've already made a decision. We're going to have guns. It's written into our Constitution. Mm-hmm. People have the right to bear arms. Mm-hmm. So unless you get a constitutional amendment, which ain't happening, okay, unless you get a constitutional amendment in that regard, we've already said our society's going to function with these weapons in our world. Mm-hmm. How do you do that responsibly?
Yep.
And to me, as a Christian, I step back and I go, it seems to me it's a perfectly reasonable conversation to ask certain things like, should our background checks be responsibly done, mm-hmm. and up to date? Should people who are not mentally in a state to handle a gun, mm-hmm. be allowed to do so? Mm-hmm. Okay. And the reason I ask that question, we treat our cars as weapons.
Absolutely.
Okay. I get a license in order to drive a car. Yep. Because the view is, if I drive that car irresponsibly, other people will get hurt. Mm-hmm. If that's true of a car,
yeah.
it might be true of a gun.
Maybe.
Okay, just maybe. Just think about it. Just think about that. So it's having that kind of a discussion that I'm talking mm-hmm. about, where we step back and we say, let's step away from the way special interests tend to frame this discussion.
Yep.
Or bring that, let them bring that to the table too, but ask these other questions alongside of it. And have a conversation about really what's the best way for us to live together.
But that brings up an interesting point, because anytime gun control is mentioned on Capitol Hill or even close to it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the other factor that
to go through security in order to get to Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's go right. ahead. Yeah. But I mean, the other factor that a lot of times, it's constantly there, but a lot of times we don't recognize it, is that there are lobbyists. There are special interest groups who are saying, And what they're doing is framing the conversation
exactly.
in a certain way that already –
they're going to take away your freedom if they tell
already,
you about your gun.
Yeah, it already puts us at a deficit
right.
in attempting to have this conversation, because if any kind of proposal –
and they're pouring
around,
money and resources, you know.
Totally.
And here's the hard part. Here's the really hard part for a Christian to think through. Most politics is built around self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called special interest groups for a reason.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And so most politics is built around self-interest. And yet the best way to function in a society is to ask the question that asks me to extend myself beyond myself.
Right. Right.
So you've got to overcome that.
Yeah.
In order to think about what's the best way for us to function
good?
Together. Yeah.
But I guarantee you, somebody listening right now is thinking, hey, they're talking about gun control legislation. They're talking about, like, I promise you, somebody's mentality is, wait a second, like, are they advocating that they take away my guns? And I think to level out that, like, I own a weapon. I have a license to carry, mm-hmm. you know, I have a long history with weapons, you know.
So you're a heat packer.
So, but I also.
There are meat packers and heat
and
packers.
Heat packers. Yeah. But I also come to the table and I'm like, I'm open to for there to be, you know, control measures in place like we do licensing.
I actually find that people, I live in Texas. I don't own a gun. I don't carry a gun. But
you live in Texas?
Yeah, that's right. But I have relatives who do and who deeply believe in it. And they do so responsibly.
Yeah.
And what I think is interesting is that people who really understand the responsibility that they have of being someone who mm-hmm. carries a weapon mm-hmm. like that, I find that many of them, I'm tempted to say most.
Yeah.
That many of them actually do appreciate having this kind of a conversation
because
they understand the responsibility that carrying a weapon actually demands of a person to do so responsibly. You know, and the odd thing is, you travel overseas on this one and to countries where they don't allow weapons to circulate like we do.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of societal violence is significantly
Absolutely.
Reduced as a result. And they ask, how in the world can you do this?
Yeah.
I was in Australia this summer doing an interview with the Center for Public Christianity. We were talking about American politics. And besides trying to understand why we are where we are, for which I had no explanation whatsoever, the next question they wanted to know is, why are Americans so infatuated with guns? You know, that was their impression. And I said, you've got to understand our history in order to understand why this was written into our Constitution. Mm. And then once you've made that decision, you've got a harder responsibility. It's all right, if you're going to allow all these weapons of minor destruction in people's hands, then how are you going to regulate it in a way that makes sense for the society?
Yeah. Let's move on then to immigration.
Okay, so being, good. You know, I'm glad you picked that one up because I almost thought this is a different one. This is the one in which the tension is a nation has an absolute right to define what its laws are, that its borders be respected, that its laws be followed. I mean, you cannot have a stable society without people doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. There also are a terrific amount of texts, in fact, a level of text that most people aren't aware of, about having sensitivity to being a foreigner. In fact, to Israel, it said, you know, basically, watch how you treat the foreigner because you know what it is to be a stranger in a strange mm-hmm. land. Mm-hmm. In fact, in some passages, it says, you even know what it is to be a slave in a strange mm-hmm. land. And so you've got those passages. Those passages are in tension with one another. Now, what some people try and do to deal with this issue is they try and say, well, there are only certain people who count as foreigners in the Old Testament, to which I go, I'm sorry, okay? I don't think when Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, he is asking us to distinguish between who our neighbor is.
Yeah, totally.
That there is a core biblical value that says my neighbor is my neighbor, and I'm responsible to care and love for them. And when the very lawyer asked the question, who's my neighbor, to really ask, aren't there some people who aren't my neighbor?
Yeah,
Jesus told the parable to absolutely not go in that place.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that those people aren't responsible for how they carry out and respond to laws and that you need to think through law and order. But our immigration discussion has become a debate about sequence. Mm-hmm. Do we fix the borders and then deal with the people internally who are in the millions that we have and that we're having to deal with?
Right.
And do we wait until the borders are fixed until we deal with that internally? And most people are arguing for some form of sequence. You fix the borders and then you work internally, to which I say, and I will admit that I have a very skeptical take on people who oftentimes do it this way. And that is, fixing the borders becomes an excuse not to deal with what's going on internally, because you're never going to totally fix your border. Even if you build a wall and get someone else to pay for it, okay? Someone's going to figure out a way to scale that wall or dig a tunnel underneath it or whatever.
People are impressive.
People are impressive in the way, I mean, ask Israel. They do it, you know, they've got walls all over the place and they've got leaks all over the place.
Yep.
So to me, on the immigration discussion, as you're dealing with these values, yes, you want to equip your borders. You want to make sure that you have integrity. But you've got this group of people here, somewhere between 11 and 12 million, many of whom were enticed to come here originally. I don't think we own moral responsibility for why we're in the situation that we're in, at least to some degree. Yes, they overstayed their visas. The way our system works is, you know, you're allowed in and you're allowed in a way that allows you in, but our system doesn't deal well with what happens after that. Mm-hmm. So if someone just stays around, okay, because we didn't check on them and don't check up on them, generally speaking, they stay around.
Yeah.
And we have no way of help. We do have a way. We have a way of sending them back so they can come back in, but we have no way from within this context of having them deal with that. So our immigration structure is incomplete, and that's producing some of our problems.
Yep.
That's why you need immigration reform and talk seriously about it. And we have some of the responsibility. Some people have enticed these other people to come in. They have sheltered them. They have hired them. They have paid them. They have helped them. They, in some cases, know that they're illegal, but still continue to work with them. And they've now been here several generations.
Right.
Okay. Now I've got kids, and in some cases, even grandkids. They've been there that long.
Yep.
So a policy that comes along and says, just break up the family. If the person's here illegally, send them home. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, given the family values that we have, that that's the best overall solution, given the tensions that we're facing. Mm-hmm. So the question of immigration is this question. Isn't there a better way mm-hmm. to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a better way to think about what we do with the 11 million people here? Now what's come into the mix in the last 5 years to make it more complicated is the terrorist threat. Okay, mm-hmm. very real, very genuine. Okay, so how do we do this in such a way that, if I can say it this way, the people who aren't seeking to infiltrate, you know, our country don't get in, But the people who are fleeing that very same violence and want out and want another place to live that's different than where they came from. I mean, who wants to live in Aleppo?
Yeah, right.
How do we build a structure that does that? Well, that takes immigration reform. But right now we're gridlocked.
Yep.
Okay. We've got the border people on one side and the compassionate people on the other. And what do we do?
And well, they've both retreated from the table and have entrenched themselves.
That's
and
right. Now 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, we were probably very, very close to actually having an agreement until the terrorist threat began to overflow and spill over into this problem. And then people backed off. And in all fairness, legitimately, I mean, there were legitimate concerns that were a part of the conversation. So my question is, as a Christian thinking about this from a humanitarian point of view and as well as politically is, you know, what prevents us from having a really good conversation and decoupling the things that we link together in terms of sequence? Why can't we work on doing a better job with regard to our borders and defining what we are while dealing with the people who are already here and figuring out a way to assimilate those who are here who really have done nothing destructive while being here? They really have contributed to our society. They're not paying into our tax system, et cetera, as they ought to be. And, you know, there's a benefit from assimilating them from that angle, et cetera. There are all kinds of reasons why we can handle this a different way.
If you're listening at home to some of these tension points, just as another resource to remind you of that, Todd has done some real truth real quicks on carrying a handgun, on immigration. In fact, I believe one came out today on should a Christian engage in politics. And so if anything we're talking about today, you're going, gosh, I'd love to continue to learn more. Those resources are out there. Let's, for the sake of time, let's jump. You said something earlier, and I want you to be able to pick up on that, on genuine worldview clash, that people tend to take tension points and yet stick them into the genuine worldview clash. But instead, in the worldview clash, there really is opposing viewpoints. And this is, how do we live together knowing we just flat out disagree?
Yeah. How do you agree to disagree together well, and that person's your neighbor? How do you families are discovering this, churches are discovering this now, because, for example, in the whole same-sex issue area, you know, there are children of parents in Christian homes who come to their mom or dad and say, hey, I'm gay. Now what are you going to do? And how does the church help that parent in that situation? Those kinds of things. Things that move, have nothing to do with what laws we have, but have everything to do with how I'm going to relate to the person. And of course, there are people who would argue that, you know, that what you do, you know, is you disown the child. You know, you state your sense of accountability. And to me, you almost do the exact opposite. What you do is you try and care and love them in the midst of your disagreement as well and as powerfully as you can. If Jesus taught something that I thought was very interesting, if people only love the people who love them, then how is their discipleship any different than what goes on in the world?
That's right.
And to me, what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount is our love is supposed to be different and distinctive. And it's in the difference and in the distinctiveness that you actually see and that there's something else going on here that's worth inquiring about.
It's easy something, to love those who are like us.
That's right.
But to love somebody who is truly different.
That's right.
And I think so many times what happens in many Christians' hearts is they go, gosh, I want to love this person well, but I'm afraid if by loving them, I'm being complicit in their sin. Yeah. And I think there's a way to say, hey, I can love and care for you while you know I disagree.
That's right.
With this part of your life, because you are more than your sexuality. You're more than your, you know, the abortion that you may think
or whatever political party you belong to.
You are not just a Democrat or not just a Republican or not just a fill in the blank. And I can see you as a person made in the image of God who I can love fiercely in the way that Christ would, while having major disagreements. I mean, Nate and I don't agree on anything, and I still have to love you. But I think there's a way to
Welcome
do that.
And I can understand you.
Thank you. But it's like I'm not on the air. I'm like reeling over OU for the last 45 minutes.
Yeah. No, I think the interesting thing here is that there is a way to do this. Mark Yarhouse, who's a psychologist who's worked in the same-sex area for years as a Christian psychologist, probably knows more about it than almost any Christian psychologist, maybe even in the world, has a phrase that he uses called convicted civility. And he's talking about how do you have conviction on the one hand, yet enough civility and communicate enough respect to the person on the other that you end up having – when you do engage, you end up actually discussing the issue,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
as opposed to trying to tear down the other person.
Right.
And that really is, I think, a phrase worth kind of hanging on to, that there is a way of engagement. There's a way to agree to disagree that can keep your discussion on the merits of the issue on the one hand. I mean, when a gay person says to me as a person, you know, if I choose a gay lifestyle, particularly if I'm a we'll call it a gay Christian, I understand I'm same sex attracted, but I also understand the Bible's against this. So I've made a decision for celibacy in terms of sexuality. I'm sitting here going, man, the church ought to rally around that person as much as possible because they need all help because what they are ultimately fighting is an intimacy and a loneliness,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
that is at risk mm-hmm. because they've taken a courageous position.
Right.
So I want to help that person, and my hope would be that the church would do everything to take that person because they've taken a sacrificial, courageous step from the way the world normally sees things,
yeah.
and the world is enticing them all the time to
totally.
Say you don't need
right.
to go there.
Sure, yeah, yep.
You have the right. You don't need to go there.
You deserve love. You're entitled to love.
Exactly
you can
right.
have that relationship,
so.
Right?
So there are ways to do this. And even in the context where a person goes, there's a beautiful book by a guy named Christopher Yuan, who is a gay Christian, who came out. And the book is about how he wasn't a Christian at the time, came out to his mom, who was a strong Christian, and their journey together mm-hmm. until he finally came to the Lord mm-hmm. or came to be aware of kind of how his sexuality worked in light of his spiritual condition and how he made a choice for singleness in the midst of that and how he's living his life in light of that. Mm-hmm. And his mother is part of this story all alongside telling what she's going through as they have this conversation.
But her presence is faithful in
her
his
presence
life
is faithful
time.
In his life.
Yeah, yeah,
and she's
yeah.
there. In fact, now when he speaks, we're getting ready to have him come in the spring to the seminary and he's going to bring his mom with him.
That's
They're
cool.
going to tell their story.
Yeah, that's good.
And so, you know, so you're sitting here going, this can be done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you get very, very exceptional things that happen as a result.
Yeah. Really, in a lot of ways, we're talking about where two kingdoms can sometimes compete with one another.
That's right.
And that is the way we would sometimes champion a political issue from our point of view and attempt to gain victory or win in that arena. And at the same time, in doing so, sacrifice or place under that priority our responsibility as citizens of the kingdom of Jesus's kingdom.
I actually think this election is heading us in that direction because we're being asked. Neither candidate is outstanding from
yep.
a Christian evaluation
right.
point of view. People are asking questions like, "Do I vote for the lesser of two evils?" That kind of thing. What you have to think about is, does my vote for this person communicate an endorsement in terms of the totality of what they offer that is a reflection of my church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in one sense, you're going to have that with every political
yeah.
candidate.
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
So you got to be careful with this question. But the problem here is that the deficits coming from both sides are so immense.
Vast, yeah.
I tell people the choice in this election is like deciding, how do I want my home to be damaged, by a hurricane or by a tornado? Okay,
right,
different
yeah.
kind of damage,
yeah.
different things. But in either case,
damage,
the damage
yeah.
is going to be significant.
Yep. Yep.
Does the church, as kind of a third way, it's supposed to be a conscience in the world, step back at a certain point and say, you both have hit my tilt button,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'll be darned, theological expression, I'll be darned if I'm going to give you the sense of an imprimatur for what you represent as a whole by suggesting that what you're asking, that my choice of you represents a good moral
mm-hmm,
choice.
Mm-hmm.
I think the church has to be very careful about going to that kind of a space. Yeah. I don't have a problem with a person who says, I'm picking this person because of this one area, and I'm going to go there. But I think you also need to realize when you do that, you're pretending to ignore a whole lot of other things
yep.
that don't look so good.
Yep.
And that's true, right? That's true in this particular election in a significant way of both of our major choices, which has made this election for, I think, a sensitive, conscientious Christian, nothing short of a nightmare.
Yep.
Because I've got a hurricane coming at me from the Gulf, and I've got a tornado coming at me and down Tornado Alley from the north.
Yep.
And the beautiful thing is they might just collide over my house.
Yeah, there you
go. Yeah, but the more beautiful thing, and really what I was able to speak to just some of the women in our women's ministry this week, is what brings us great comfort in this is knowing that America is not our first and highest kingdom, mm-hmm. that ultimately there are competing kingdoms, and we belong to one where there are no more tornadoes and
which
hurricanes.
Which is precisely why you shouldn't be nervous, frustrated,
yeah.
terrified,
yeah,
or
yeah,
any of the, all the normal reactions that you normally see.
That desire
people.
To win, which I have,
yeah.
which I understand
right.
what people bring. Like,
right.
The great thing is the victory
That's
is mine in the first.
It's already
part.
There.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
Can relax. I have nothing ultimately significantly at risk other than a fallen world that I already live in.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? And so it may be a question of how fallen it is, but at least I can step back and say, I know my security, my identity, my relationship and who I am transcends everything that's bothering everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which I think to end our time, because we are out of time. I know this time flies.
Mm-hmm.
But to end our time, I think that a couple of passages, a couple of statements from Jesus are in my mind right now. And one of them is where he's talking to his disciples. And I think we're starting to appreciate even on a deeper level, given the world we live in, the depth of a statement like this, where he says, in this world, you are going to have trouble,
mm-hmm.
you know, but take heart. I have overcome the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, the kingship of Jesus is something that we submit to and rest in. There's a rest. There's a, my yoke is easy. My burden is light. And at the same time, I think talking about the Sermon on the Mount at the beginning of it, Jesus is saying, to his followers, the people in his kingdom, you're the salt of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You're the light of the world. You're a city that's going to be set up on a hill,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think as we think as followers of Jesus, as disciples of Jesus, that's something that's true about us. And that is, and is also a responsibility of ours as we cooperate with Jesus through his Spirit to be beacons of light in this craziness,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get out of the trench and meet people in the middle and to be able to extend beyond yourself
mm-hmm.
in the power of Jesus. And so all of those principles, I think apply here and definitely as we continue to engage our culture, hopefully, you know, this hour has been a time well spent for you. And if there's anything we can do to further equip you in this, we'd love to chat with you. But Dr. Bach, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
For giving us your time. Next month, we're going to have Dr. Paul Copen, who wrote Is God a Moral Monster? And we're going to talk to him about difficult passages in the Old Testament like genocide, slavery, sexual abuse, other stuff like that. So tune in. Help us get the word out on this. Tell a friend. We'd love for a good chunk of our body to tune into this. We appreciate you guys tuning in, and we hope to see you next time.